Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I'm thinking of a cold river up north, a river that I've been planning to go to for, well, ever since I had my health issues. And working hard, rehabbing, trying to squeeze into the waders. And I'm thinking of all the fish in that river hiding under the logs, coming in from the big lake, ready to pounce on a fly. There's the spotted Haley and the sad DeSantis, the cloudy Biden who can't even find the fly. He can't even find his way off the stage in his speech. And there's always the one lurking under the water, the Michelle Obama. Savage, relentless, and if she breaks water, I think she'll take my line and everything we have and everything I own and rip it down along the river and be gone, because I don't think they're stopping her. But now I return to my favorite political angler, Tom Bevin, president and co-founder of Real Clear Politics. Hey, Tom, are you in?
I'm checking my schedule to see if there's anything available.
Because we have guides available and fishermen available and wine available, because I listened to your podcast, the Takeaway podcast, an excellent, most excellent podcast, one of my favorites, along with your other adventure, which is now the polling podcast. We can talk about that. But in it, we have wine. And I know that from listening to that podcast that you and Carl Cannon are forever trading that mythical, excellent bottle of wine back and forth.
Correct. Yes.
To satisfy your bets.
Exactly.
So Steve the pilot and Ross the baker and Dan Proft, our friend Dan Proft, who's coming with us, want to know if you're going to be able to come up to the... There, I've said it. Cut it out, Jeff. Cut out the word.
Well, I will.
But to come with us to that beautiful river up north, and hope you can make it.
Well, I will do my best.
I won't badger you anymore. But I do think that since you like going on activities with the kids, that it's always something I wanted to do with my son, you know, to begin to do it and take them with me up there. It's a good, no screens, no phones, no, you know.
Yeah. No, I totally get that.
All right. So, Beck, now we're kind of chilled out in our zen, thinking of the river and the calmness. But let's get into the contentiousness of presidential politics. You're going to New Hampshire this week. What are you going to see there besides more carnage?
Probably more of what I saw in Iowa when I was out there last week, which is, you know, Donald Trump winning. I mean, it looks like, you know, we had two polls come out this morning, the Boston Globe Suffolk tracking poll, which showed Trump. That started about 5 days ago, and Trump's lead had been, you know, roughly in the 14% range, and then it kind of ticked up, and now it ticked up again. He's up 19 points in that poll. CNN poll conducted with the University of New Hampshire came out just minutes ago and has Trump up 11. So he's up 15 points in our Real Clear Politics average. He's over 50%, 50.3. Haley's at 35.3. And poor Ron DeSantis is down at 6.3. So, look, could there be an upset on Tuesday? It's possible. Anything's possible. And certainly the electorate in New Hampshire, which is, you know, a good chunk of independents.
Flinty. I think the way we describe them is flinty, right?
Flinty. Yeah. Right. But man, it looks like, you know, Trump had a rally in Manchester last night that was just absolutely packed to the rafters with people, you know, around the block waiting to get in the freezing cold. Nikki Haley doesn't seem to have any of that kind of energy. And, you know, she's really relying on independents and Democrats to cross over and vote for her. And it seems like, you know, she is winning a decent number of independents, but I'm just not sure that it's going to be enough. And certainly, even if it is, when you turn around and go to South Carolina, which is the next contest, which is 3 weeks away, that's a closed primary. And even though it's her home state, only Republicans can vote. And Trump is leading there by 20 or 30 points. So maybe there'll be a surprise on Tuesday night that extends this contest a little bit further. But I think, you know, if you kind of take a broader view of it, it ends badly for Haley and for DeSantis in the, you know, relatively near future, I would think.
Tom, I love having you on, and thanks so much for joining us too, especially this, you know, hotbed of political fun.
Sure.
This is the time of year when I think of Tom Bevin. I mean, I think of Tom, you know, Real Good Politics every day, but this is the one I'm like, I love to see what's happening, Tom. I imagine you like the wizard behind the curtain with all the polls and everything going on. Well, I'd love to get your take, because there's been this pushback, right? This is what like the CNNs and MSNBCs of the world. They're like, oh, Donald Trump won, but only, you know, 15% of all people in Iowa voted. And of that, you know, whatever, they narrow it down to say, well, you know, a handful of people really voted for Trump.
Right, right.
I wanted your take on that, because when I heard that, I'm like, first of all, it sounds like too many ifs, thens to make and to be of any usefulness as a data point. But what is your response when you heard that? Because that's what I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, listen, so you can argue that caucus turnout was lower than people thought it was going to be. Now, it was cold. I mean, it was freezing cold, and the roads were not great. But, you know, it's Iowa. I mean, these people know how to drive in the snow. It's not like the folks in Washington, D.C., where two flakes fall and, you know, schools are closed. I mean, these people know how to get around. So maybe you could make the argument that turnout was emblematic of the dread that, you know, the party feels, you know, heading toward a general election that's going to be Trump versus Biden. But, you know, that's speculation a little bit. But what is true, what is absolutely true, is that Donald Trump won 98 out of 99 counties. He only lost Johnson County, which is where I was, by one vote to Nikki Haley. And by the way, we had a number, just in the caucus location that I was at, we had a number of people show up, Democrats, register on the spot as Republicans and vote for Haley. So absent those people, Trump would have won that county as well. And his margin probably would have been a little bit bigger in other portions around the state. And he won the biggest victory that any Republican has ever had in a caucus in Iowa. I mean, Bob Dole in 96, I think 12 points was
huge.
Right. So just based on those results, you would have to say that, you know, Trump had a resounding victory in Iowa. I mean, I don't think there's any other way. And some of these articles that have come out, like, oh, it was only 3% of the overall voting electorate in Iowa and blah, blah. It's like, okay, well, you know, it's always been that way. And suddenly they're trying to like diminish Trump's accomplishment because, you know, and paint him as more vulnerable than he probably is. I think that's kind of silly just based
on the numbers. Thinking.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you know, and I also think this idea that, well, you know, Trump's you know, basically the incumbent, and therefore, you know, you had almost 50% of Iowans vote for somebody else. It's like, oh, okay. But again, I think that's kind of a silly way of looking at it. I mean, Donald Trump is in a very, and he's been in this position, a very strong position for months. This is not, you know, breaking news. This is not, you know, revelatory in any way. He is a very, very strong candidate for rank and file Republican voters around the country. He demonstrated that strength in Iowa. He's, you know, going to demonstrate it probably again in New Hampshire. And if for some reason there is an upset, you know, I mean, you go look at some of these polls that are out there on Super Tuesday, where he is in California, where he is in the South. I mean, he's just, it's going to be really, really hard to stop him. And I honestly don't think that Nikki Haley has enough support within the rank and file of the party to pull it off.
Well, you could put him in jail, right?
That's the
playbook. You lock him behind bars. Isn't that the idea?
So
I mean, I'm not really, as you know, and so some of you know, I'm not a big real Trump fan. I'm not a Trumpian.
Me neither.
I know that he's not a conservative. I'm a conservative. He's not. But, you know, he can't stand Mitch McConnell. And my enemy, my friend of my enemy is my friend or however that works. And so I'm with him there.
Yeah, but I mean, even listen, that's more of a general election thing, right?
Right.
I mean, Trump, none of these indictments have hurt him in the primary. They've helped him. And if you were to get thrown in jail or something, I mean, it wouldn't change the outcome of the primary. I mean, I think that's pretty clear.
Yes.
And the question is, you know, Democrats think, well, if he's convicted of any one of these 91 counts, that's going to be, you know, trouble. And they cite some polling data that suggests that might be the case. I'm a little skeptical of that as well. I think a lot of that stuff is already baked in the cake, and that, you know, Republicans are going to vote. The vast majority of Republicans are going to vote for him anyway. The vast majority of Democrats are going to vote against him. And the question is, well, how many of these sort of swing voters, independents, again, only in the states that matter. I don't care about swing voters in, you know, New York or Illinois or California. It's Georgia. It's Arizona. It's Michigan, Pennsylvania. What?
Are there any swing voters in Illinois? I don't know.
Oh, sure they are, John. We've been talking about this. Our state's withering on the vine. Every day, I think there's a larger and larger glut of them.
But to Tom's larger point, yeah, he doesn't care about the swing states or what he counts. What counts here in the general election, right?
How many of those voters are going to switch their vote based on the fact that Trump gets indicted or gets convicted of one or more of these counts? And it's like, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I may not be that many at all. And for every one that decides that, you know, I can't vote for a convicted felon for president, there might be one or two that say, you know what, Trump was railroaded. The media has gone overboard. This is insane. And so they might switch their vote and it might actually help him. So I just don't, I think that's unknowable.
Yes.
And I think we have to wait and see that play out. But certainly in the primary setting, it's not going to matter.
You know, one thing that is knowable is that Real Clear Politics, and this I'm asking as I gleaned this from the podcast, and I think it's great. Go to Real Clear Politics and read something from a writer with whom you disagree. Try it. It's what we used to call America back when I was a boy. And, you know, I looked at the Sunday. We're speaking to you on Sunday morning. And I'm thinking the one thing I have to read is, can the MAGA shrew be tamed by the MAGA shrew herself, Maureen Dowd of the New York Times? I can't wait to open this one and look at it and read it.
Yeah, I mean, listen, this is part of what we, you know, do every day and have been doing, yeah, for the better part of 20, almost 25 years now, is aggregating content, which is opinion, analysis, polls, videos, everything from across the political spectrum, and trying to present sort of the best of the best for people. And, you know, Maureen Dowd's on the front page. Tom Friedman's on the front page. We've got, you know, a couple of columns from The Guardian, which is a left-leaning newspaper. We've got some
Ben Dominich. Sort of, yeah, right.
Exactly. We've got some right-leaning stuff from Ben Dominich and Aaron Flanagan and Roger Kimball.
Great original stuff too.
But also, you know, Dan Balz. Okay, a lot of people might think he's a centrist or he's like a sort of left-leaning. You know, but he's a legendary sort of legacy reporter, and it's his, you know, what's also interesting about, you know, sort of the dynamic of journalism. You know this, John, like it used to be, and I've said this before on the show, it used to be that you would work your entire career in journalism to be able to cover a presidential campaign. And that changed, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, where they just started hiring these young kids and giving them cameras and putting them on the bus, right? And paying them nothing and just saying, I want you to videotape everything and just, you know, write these little write-ups. And while that did, I think, increase the amount of information that we got, right? Transparency wise, we know, like, okay, you know, Newt Gingrich said this at this event, he said this at that event or whatever. There was a protest at this event.
Right.
It was all of that. It was it was more information, but it was all stripped of like historical context. And there were only a few guys that are still around that have that. And Dan Balls is one of them, who have that kind of historical knowledge. And so it's nice to read people who actually know some political history about, you know, how these are
and actually
covered. Yeah. I mean, we're covering these races in the 1980s and the 1990s. Cause some of these kids that are out there covering politics today, like they can't even tell you who ran against Bill Clinton. You know, I mean, so we have some of that as well, mixed in on the page.
That was last century, Tom. Come on.
Exactly.
but it's important. The thing is that Tom illustrates, I think, Tom, would you agree? You might agree that you illustrate here the failure of the large corporation companies or interests, and I'm talking about yourself. Telling your own story is a very difficult matter, right? I mean, it's difficult for most people. And your story is unique in the sense that, you know, as a news consumer, it's unique and important. And I find that you get glimpses of it when I listen to you and Carl Cannon and others on the podcast, the Real Clear Takeaway podcast, which is on, I think, 3 times a week, if not 4 a week. And yeah, I hear you arguing about, you know, bottles of wine that Carl owes you and you owe Carl. But basically, I don't hear what you just said. And there is no, I think in the media landscape now, which is so narrow casted for subscriptions narrowly, you know, so we can't lose any of our left-wing Jacobin frenzy readers because I can't write about anything that Mitch McConnell may have done. We tend to lose all that, and we become even more locked into our silo.
Well, I think that's definitely been a trend that's taken place in the industry, and it's look, it has we've seen it. I mean, there used to be that's one of the things that as someone who gets up and consumes a lot of news and opinion every single day, you know, it's gotten less fun and less interesting over the last few years because of the tribal nature. There used to be people out there that, you know, would write interesting things and you know, heterodox things and things that were surprising. Now it's kind of like, you know, and this kind of started with Obama. You know, there was a lot of cheerleading in the media. He was great. Oh, everything God. He did was great. That's nothing he did right. was.
They were on the hopium pipe.
It accelerated under Trump, where the media kind of, you know, basically declared themselves part of the resistance. And then, you know, everything he did, right, was the 5-alarm fire and how he was destroying all these norms. And he never, you know, nobody ever praised him. Nobody on the left ever praised him, even when he did things that they agreed with on trade or China. You know, he's like he had some Bernie Sanders type policies, and nobody on the left could say those were good policies because they would absolutely get, you know, destroyed by their constituents. Right. And it's the same thing with Biden, right? Everything Biden does is a disaster, you know, according to Republicans, and everything he does is great. No matter, I mean, the border is one example, but where, you know, Democrats just absolutely, they have to defend him to the hilt. He can never, you know, he's never doing anything wrong. With maybe the exception of, and this was the sort of one of the clarifying moments of October 7th. But same thing for Republicans. So it's become very sort of binary and tribal, and that makes consuming particularly opinion stuff, just a total slog, right? Yeah. So predictable that, we struggle to try and find good stuff for the front page that'll keep people interested. That's kind of, you know, adds a little bit of interesting arguments and sort of unpredictability, and it's become a lot harder.
I take that as an admonition, and I take it to heart. But as a media mogul myself, who you know, relies on the subscriptions of readers for my bread, I find that any deviation from what they want gets them extremely upset, and people get extremely upset.
So are you saying you're part of the problem, John?
I might just be. I mean, right now, I heard you mention the border, and I'll just mention it here. The border to me is like almost of a revolutionary issue. It's like watching, can I quote myself, the Marquis de Evermond and his coaches running down a little innocent boy in Paris. It's the same idea. People are, and then you throw them a few coppers and the coppers go into the mud and you write off, you know, the people I've never seen the American people so angry. They're stunned. They're angry. Yeah. They can't take it. They're like wordless, speechless in anger. And I wonder how that works out.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about the border more, but in your defense, okay, you are a one man band doing your thing,
right?
You've sort of decided to make a break from, you go to these big news organizations though, and you go to, like, let's say the New York Times.
Oh,
I mean, yeah. They hardly have, everybody on that staff is writing basically the same thing. Even the so-called conservatives, right? You got David Brooks and now David French, who writes just every column every week is
Trump sucks.
About how awful, right. You know, MAGA voters are and whatever. I mean, he literally can't write for the New York Times anything remotely positive about Trump supporters or Trump himself or, right. You know, without getting basically run out of town. Same thing at the Washington Post. Same thing.
Are you saying that Selena Zito and I have no future at the New York?
No. But interestingly, right, some of the people who have broken off to do their own thing have been coming from the op, Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald, right. And some from of these
the
sort of
right
from the left, and people who do have sort of interesting, anti-conventional wisdom things to say, and they've found themselves. Barry Weiss, for example, who, you know, started the Free Press.
Lover. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, just found themselves too constrained by the organizations, the media organizations that they were working for, and unable to actually say what they felt and believed to be real. And I think you kind of fall into that category, although coming at it from a different perspective a little bit.
When you started Real Clear Politics 30 years ago now?
2000 basically. So okay. 24 years ago.
And basically when I'd have a piece when I wrote for the paper, it would be picked up by Real Clear Politics. Now I wonder at that time, were you thinking about the evolution of the business, the subscription model versus the general circulation model, and how that would create silos that would basically break the business, break it to what we see today?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting two and a half decades to be involved in the media business and watch it kind of just basically be, you know, destroyed and reinvented and destroyed again. I mean, you've got, you know, Sports Illustrated just announced they're laying off everybody going to use AI to write sports stories. I mean, so we're seeing like yet another iteration of this with some of the artificial intelligence stuff. But I mean, we think about it all the time because particularly, you know, we have our own writers. We have a small staff covering the White House, covering Congress, covering elections. And, you know, submitting columns and whatnot, but for the most part, you know, we aggregate. And so we're dependent upon, you know, being able to have our readers have access to these articles. And so when people start putting up paywalls, if you want to see readers get really mad, you should see some of our readers when they click on a link on Real Clear Politics and get hit with a paywall. Or registration. I mean, we get nasty emails all the time. No, you know, there's nothing that infuriates people more than that.
It's my news and I want it now.
Did I take care of that for you? I mean, did I take care of that? There, remember?
I believe we have solved that problem for John Cass News. Yes.
All right. Good.
But yeah, I mean, they've made a conscious proactive decision to say, I want to read this, and clicked on it and then can't get to it. So, you know, there are, you know, different tricks that we have up our sleeve to do some of that stuff. But, you know, there's been this, there's been, with the explosion of stuff, I mean, this has been part of our journey as well, is, you know, a lot of the voices now are outside of these organizations. They're on Substack, they're on Medium, they're, you know, doing whatever and trying and trying to find those people and you know, aggregate their viewpoints as well. It's a challenge, but we are, we continue to do our best.
Tom, while we got you, I know I love everyone who knows the podcast. I love numbers and polls, and it always gets me excited. But I, where we are now, like this idea that Ron DeSantis is seemingly just, you know, he's gone. Toast. It's over for him.
My favorite candidate.
Right. Right. Did you think it would be this stark of a no to Ron DeSantis at this point? I mean, it felt like what he was doing in Florida up until, you know, this election race started was like prototypical Trump. Like he was doing all the things that everybody wanted, and Trump even moved to his state, and then he doesn't have anything. Like there's no gas. What toasted him?
So great question. There's a new story out from NBC News reporting about his campaign and how, you know, basically sort of a post-mortem, even though it's not officially dead yet, but included all of the sort of, you know, traditional gaffes that these, some of these folks get in. They got in, they hired a ton of people and thought they were going to build this, you know, juggernaut. And so they get payroll heavy, and then they're, you know, then they're really reliant on donations and having to raise money, and candidate spends a lot of time doing that. They had, you know, they struggled from the beginning with their message, what it was going to be. And there's some reporting on that in this NBC story. There was also this idea, you know, they, because they were sort of cash strapped, they turned to the PAC, and the PAC had sort of outsized influence. And then you had some turnover there, and it just sort of chaos, general chaos and confusion. So it looked like it was a real sort of cluster right from the beginning. In DeSantis's, in his defense, there's the argument that, you know what, even if he had done everything right, he wouldn't have beaten Trump anyway, right? Trump's just Trump. And once he decided to run, nobody was going to beat him. So you could maybe fault DeSantis for thinking, and again, go back and you see the stories. People were, you know, after his victory, everybody was in his ear whispering to him, hey, you got to do this for the good of the party, for the good of the country. You're the only guy who can do it. You'll have as much money as you need. We'll be there for you. And he got talked into it, basically. He's a young guy. He could have easily waited 4 years and done it, you know, and been the guy next time around, whether Trump won or lose, because Trump's only going to serve one term, right? But he got into it.
Hopefully.
So, so that was maybe his first mistake, was getting in the first place when he should have waited. His second mistake was hiring Jeff Rowe, who runs Axiom, you know, consulting, who ran basically Ted Cruz's campaign, which did not go well in 2016, right? Didn't end up winning the nomination, to run his campaign. So he's taking a, you know, a sort of recycled strategist to run a recycled campaign. And the idea all along was, right, that there's this window. And I think there really was a window where, you know, there are people who liked Trump and supported Trump in 2016, 2020 were open to looking for someone else. And they did, you know, but that window was, it was open for a limited period of time. And when DeSantis got out there finally and got going on his campaign, he did not have the proper tone. He did not have the proper message to try and take advantage of that and win over those voters. He was attacking Trump on different things, but kind of, he wasn't attacking him, you know, in the same way that like Chris Christie was. But he wasn't doing what Vivek did, which was kind of, you know, basically trying to woo Trump voters in a significant way. And so as a result, he kind of ended up in the middle. And you know what they say about folks who end up in the middle of the road, they get run over. And that's basically what happened. And you can see that in his numbers. You go back and look at, you know, when he got in April, he was at 30%. Trump was at 45. I mean, it was a 15-point race.
Yeah.
But after that, it just kind of all went downhill, and you had the indictments, which obviously helped Trump. But DeSantis did himself no favors from the time that he got into the race, and I think we're seeing that now. And so the writing was on the wall for DeSantis for a pretty long time, and he never really course corrected. He never fired the guy. He just kind of, I think he'll look back. And again, a lot of folks, you know, the history is littered with all these candidates who screwed up, and, you know, Tim Pawlenty and Scott Walker and all these folks who look great on paper, and they get into the race, and for whatever reason, they run not a great campaign. They don't make a connection with voters, and they're not able to rise above, and they just, you know, crash and burn.
Occam's razor says that theory tells us to go for the most simple explanation is often true. And I think the most simple explanation of this one is that people wanted Trump. They wanted, and when they thought he was finished and he was gone, they wanted somebody like him to come back and kick ass. And then he came back, and so there was no need for DeSantis.
My read on it was like the Republicans, you know, like you said, after 2020, we'd moved on. They're like, you know, we tried and he failed. And
you mean like the Tea Party?
No. But I mean, like, if you look at the polling too, even like the idea on like who's the like the January 6th thing, and I don't want to jump into like the depth on it, but the polling on it right after was after the election was, hey, you know, Trump was probably involved, whatever. Now it shifted to it was probably an inside job or whatever it is. That thinking is shifted, and DeSantis didn't catch any of that. And when the indictments came down, it was over. I mean, the people were like, oh, we can move towards somebody else, and Ron looks like a good idea. But Trump was just laying in wait, and it was inevitable. And I really think it was his shoes. I think it was Ron DeSantis' shoes that's saying because I swear to God, okay. I mean, even my wife latched onto that and was like, is this legit? Like, it percolated into all these weird crevices of the internet. And
speaking of wives, my wife likes him, DeSantis, most because she's a suburban wife and doesn't like Trump, okay? And B, she likes DeSantis and the family story and his wife and his, you know, support of his wife and family. And I think there are many out there, they see that and they resent it. They resent what's happened to him. But that's just me.
I think, John, there's a lot to what you said, though, which is this goes back to the, like, listen, you know, nobody could have beat Trump, because why are you going to vote for sort of a
half,
you know? Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, when you can get the full real deal, why are you going to vote for a substitute or an imposter?
Skim milk.
I mean, it's just kind of like, so, you know, warts and all, we're going to take the real deal. The other thing about DeSantis's campaign, which he struggled with, was this idea that, you know, he kept trying to tell people that I'm the stronger general election candidate. Biden doesn't want to run against me. And that was never supported by the data. I mean, the polls showed that Trump ran as well, if not better, than DeSantis this entire time. And so that he was never really able to leverage that argument in a real way with voters that, you know, that he was somehow the massively superior general election candidate.
What about the vice presidential sweepstakes now? You see Nikki Haley, the child of Mitch McConnell, being the vice president? I don't.
No, I don't. And you've seen enough pushback. I mean, Tucker Carlson and others have said, listen, if that's a bridge too far, even for hardcore Trump supporters, they would rebel. So
they would make me a Democrat again.
Yeah. And so but Politico had a story out saying basically, you know, that's the hottest race right now. The hottest primary contest is not anything it's who's Trump going to pick for his VP.
All right.
So Phil Wegman, our reporter, is up in New Hampshire, and he wrote a story this morning about Elise Stefanik, and she's there stumping for Trump. And her name is very much in the conversation. You just had Tim Scott fly up there and snub Nikki Haley and endorse Donald Trump. His name is in the conversation. And then you've had, you know, some others that have been lingering and have been part of this conversation that's now going to start reaching a fevered pitch here in the next week or so. Carrie Lake, Kristi Noem, Tulsi Gabbard is someone who'd been mentioned. Vivek is another one I think that's maybe unlikely, but I think the one thing that's become clear is it's not going to be Nikki Haley. I don't even Trump.
Of course not.
You know, Trump can get away with a lot. I mean, he does get away with a lot, but that one I think he can't get away with.
He could shoot somebody on the.
He could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, but he couldn't pick Nikki Haley as his vice president.
Right. As long as it's not Nikki Haley.
All right, but there's another thing. Since you're mentioning lingering, the lingering pain of like a planter's wart keeps coming up on my foot every time I think of buying you another steak dinner, which I haven't. I still owe you for the Michelle Obama prophecy, because even though you supported my mayoral campaign, which was short lived, during that time, you also came up with the Michelle Obama prophecy. And I'm obviously like leading into a column that I'll write, but is she going to be the nominee?
Yeah. What's the Michelle Obama pathway?
John, it would have been so great if you had been elected mayor, and then you could have transferred power to me while you were going through your medical issue. And then I would have been running the city of Chicago. It would have been amazing.
And we wouldn't have had panic attacks because we know what we're doing. Right. But what do we do with Michelle Obama now?
So Michelle Obama, this is the story that won't go away. And it won't go away because, you know, Joe Biden's job approval rating is at 40%. Okay. Right. And he's in some polls it's been in the low. ABC News had him at 33, 28% among independents. I think overall on our average, he's at 40. And he's trailing Trump by about 2 points in the national polls, but even more in some of these swing states. I mean, we had a poll come out in Michigan the other day. He's down like 8 points. He's trailing by 8 points in Georgia. I mean, these are scary, scary numbers for Democrats. And the longer they continue, the more I think you will hear about Michelle Obama. And Michelle Obama is, I mean, the reason you'll continue to hear about her, because she's the only answer to the question of who else. Because, you know, Gavin Newsom doesn't do it. J.B. Pritzker doesn't do it. There's nobody else. And it's certainly not Kamala Harris. And that's the problem. Michelle Obama is the only one who could come in and, you know, be coronated in Chicago in July or whenever the convention's going to be. And every Democrat around the country would be like, yep, I get it. I'm on board. There would be no, you know, even Kamala's folks would have to be like, yeah, you know, okay, fine. Because any other answer, and you're gonna have hurt feelings, and you're gonna have a tear in the coalition just weeks before the election, that is gonna be a real problem for Democrats getting out their voters. And so she's the answer. And the question is, you know, does she want to do it?
Oh God. I
it's,
oh God. There's no stopping her. Is there? I don't think so. If she wanted it and she's like, honey, you know, if Barack Obama said, well, let's see, FDR had 4 terms, but I'm going to have 6, you know,
look, if I honestly think if she wanted it, she would absolutely. They would figure out a way to get her the nomination. Biden would stay on the ballot. Biden would, you know, he'd have to say, I want to spend more time with my family or whatever. And all my delegates, you know, vote for whatever. And then the question is, well, how would she fare against a general election with Trump? I do think, listen, I think you go back to Occam's razor. I tell people when I give speeches and they ask me what the future holds, I say it's a combination of Occam's razor, right, Murphy's Law and chaos theory all rolled into one. Yeah. I mean, whatever the craziest stuff that you can imagine happening is going to happen. Trump may get thrown in jail. You know, he may get assassinated. Michelle Obama may be the nominee. God. I mean, anything you can think of is within the realm of possibility in this kind of environment, because it's crazy out there, and it's only going to get crazier. And so I think I don't rule anything out.
I think I think she would win. She would. I talked to
Michelle.
Yeah. I mean, she would defeat Trump, for God's sake.
I mean, independents and Democrats would coalesce around. I mean, if they had a choice,
the suburban, the awfuls, you know, the awfuls and the angry white female liberals in the suburbs. We know many of them. You know, so they're usually at a wine, you know, drinking wine at a book club that for a book they haven't read. But still. they would vote for Michelle.
She would be a formidable general election candidate. There's no question. There's no question.
Oh, man. Well, if we start seeing stories coming out as Biden's like health issues start becoming more and more prevalent, they can see them seeding this the case for, because, you know, they're not going to just pull the trigger and be like, oh, we got to go. It's going to be, oh, he slipped and fell here and he's been in the hospital for a day, or he's had pneumonia, or whatever it is. It's going to build up. And then finally, they're like, you know, he's too sick.
Gentlemen, I have to break in here because we started this discussion talking about a river up north, and there's no other way to describe Michelle Obama's candidacy than walking into an icy river for me. I don't know how else to put it delicately.
I'm sure for liberals it'd be like, you know, walking into a warm bath. I mean,
right.
Who knows?
Right.
But we haven't seen any real polling on this. It's hard to know exactly. And again, the country's pretty tribal. I mean, you look, you know, Republicans are going to turn out and vote for Trump, and Democrats are going to turn out and vote for whomever the nominee is. But I think she would have a good deal of appeal to a lot of independents. So,
and you would get that steak dinner and a bottle Woo-hoo! Of wine. Because Tom Bevin, you came up with the Michelle prophecy.
Right.
Right.
Long time ago.
The OG. It hasn't
come true. I'm like, yeah, OG prophecy. I get that bottle of wine for you and just have to turn around and give it to Cannon. So that's a problem. I wouldn't even get to enjoy it.
Well, thanks for being here with us. Thanks.
Good luck in New Hampshire.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
For Tom Bevin, president and co-founder of Real Clear Politics, and for Jeff Carlin, executive producer of WGN Radio, husband to Christine, and future physics teacher, and for me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of johncassnews.com, where you always get a good cup of common sense. Thanks for joining us on the Chicago Way podcast, and join us again next time, won't you? On the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.